Energy and Environment Committee, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2211 relating to the business energy tax credit. And I want to thank members for their hard work. We have heard in the past week a lot of detailed information about a lot of very important energy issues, so I appreciate all the hard work that the committee members have done, their excellent questions, and also the Department of Energy and their staff, and many of the folks who testified here today. You have before you the LC 1, 2, and dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2211, and I'm now going to ask Mr. Graney from the Department of Energy to walk the committee through the amendments. Mr. Graney. Okay, does anyone see Mr. Graney?
He was in the room.
Yeah. I think he got pulled up. Well, we're waiting for Mr. Graney. I just wanted to let the committee members know that after we've had a little change in the order of the agenda, that we are actually going to have the work session on 2211 and 2212 first, and then have Andy Ginsberg come up. Basically, we're moving the work session on 2210 back towards the end of the agenda, and it will most likely continue into Monday. Thank you, Mr. Graney. So we're on House Bill 2211 with the dash 1, 2, 3 amendments in front of us, and if you could walk the committee through them, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Graney, Director of Department of Energy. Again, 2211 is the bill that makes a number of changes to the business energy tax credit that we've discussed previously and you're all familiar with. The dash 1 amendment, there was a blank line left in the bill inadvertently that didn't define high-performance homes eligible for the tax credit that home builders could receive the tax credit for. This clarifies that refers to another section on energy efficiency and renewable energy that we will use as criteria in rulemaking, and there's industry standards on what that constitutes. So that's the dash 1 amendment. Dash 2 simply makes a clarification to the pass-through provision that we discussed previously, whereby either a company with limited tax liability or a nonprofit such as a school or other entity that doesn't have tax liability can use what we call a pass-through payment mechanism to receive the present value of the tax credit as a cash payment, and another entity with tax liability takes that tax credit over the 5 years. This makes clarification so that investor-owned utilities can serve as pass-through payers. They have been previously, and there was some question they could do so, and this is a needed technical change so that they can continue to serve that role. And then the third amendment, and this was in discussion that we had Wednesday, makes it clear that facilities that have not been completed or prior to January 1st, 2007 are eligible for the increased tax credit that's provided by this bill. So this was to encourage projects to go forward with planning stages and initial financing and development stages, not wait until, for example, next year to begin. This will allow those projects that have done initial planning, initial partial construction, moving forward in other ways, short of completion, to receive the increased tax credit. And that's what the three amendments do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Graney, and I appreciate the expediency that your agency has worked very closely with Legislative Council to make sure that we clarified, and especially with the date of certification. So I really appreciate that. Are there any questions for Mr. Graney on any of these amendments? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the LC-1 amendment dated January 29th, 2007, to House Bill 2211.
Okay. Representative Cannon moves the dash 1 amendments, and those are dated 12907 to House Bill 2211. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, those are the opinion that the LC-1 amendments dated 112907 should be adopted. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Hurley.
Aye.
Representative
Representative Stanley.
Aye.
Representative Stewart.
Aye.
Chair Danefeld.
Aye. Motion carries, and the Dash 1 amendments have been adopted. And thank you very much.
Madam Chair, could I make another motion?
I would welcome it.
I move the Dash 2 amendments dated January 29, 2007 to House Bill 2211.
Representative Cannon moves the Dash 2, House Bill 2211 Dash 2 amendments dated 1-29-07. And I will have the clerk call the roll. Is there any discussion on those? Not? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative
Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Okay, the motion carries, and the Dash 2 amendments have been adopted.
Madam Chair, I move the LC-3 amendments dated 2207 to House Bill 2211.
Representative Cannon moves the Dash 3 amendments dated 20207 to House Bill 2211. Is there any discussion? Okay, those that opinion that the Dash 3 amendments dated 20207 should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Byers?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
Cannon? Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, the motion carries and the Dash 3 amendments have been adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2211 as amended by the LC-1, Dash 2, and Dash 3 amendments LC-1 is dated 12907, LC-2 is also dated 12907, LC-3, Dash 3 is dated 2207. Move them to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the House Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2211 with the Dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I just want to put something on the record here, which is that our function is as a policy committee, and that this is going to the Revenue Committee, and the one feature of this bill that I'd say is an open item to me is the interaction with the federal credit, and I'm would understand that the Revenue Committee would be focusing on that and their function as the guardian of our state's revenue, and I hope that they will focus in on the magnitude impact of that change.
So noted. Thank you, Mr. Representative McPherson. Any other discussion items? Okay. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2211 with the Dash 1 and 2 and 3 amendments should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill will be referred to the House Revenue Committee, will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byers?
Aye.
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 Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson? Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed. Thank you.
Thank
you, committee members. And Mr. Graney, don't go away because we now have House Bill 2212.
Okay.
So I'd like to call to order a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee and open a work session on House Bill 2212 relating to the residential energy tax credit. Again, this is a bill that we heard much testimony on in the past week. A companion bill to the 2211, and Mr. Graney, if you could give us some overview of the amendments and how this affects the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the features of the bill, as we had intended it to be introduced, was to allow multiple tax credits if you buy multiple solar systems, for example, a hot water heating system and a photovoltaic electric system. If you buy multiple energy-efficient appliances, the bill, as it came back drafted, partially did that, but still had a a cap of $1,500, which is the normal individual amount of tax credit for many of those devices. The amendment simply makes some technical clarifications to do the our original intent, which is to allow, as long as you buy multiple systems in 1 year, you can qualify for that tax credit in that same year.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grainier. Are there any questions for Mr. Grainier?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Would Mr. Grainier please read the line 33 as it will be amended in the bill for me?
Line 33.
On what page, Representative Jensen?
Page 3.
Okay.
The first part of this amendment.
Under Section 2.
It's under Section 2, 1A. I'm sure I understand the...
The English is still going to be a little awkward, but it will read, a resident individual should be allowed a credit against the taxes otherwise due under this chapter for costs paid or incurred for construction or installation of each of one or more alternative energy devices in a dwelling, and that each of our Assistant Attorney General assured me is the fix we need to make it clear that you get the credit for each device that you purchase.
You're right. The English is a little awkward, but at least in my opinion.
But apparently, without that, we still didn't accomplish what we were trying to accomplish in this bill.
Okay.
And then you see the word each throughout the various other lines,
right.
And that's why that word is used.
Okay.
Representative Jensen, do you have a follow-up?
I said it's still awkward, you know, if that's where the certified smart people have to confuse us.
They often do
not
that.
Not so smart people, you know, okay.
Any other questions, Mr. Grainier? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just wanted to make sure that I was reading it the way
you were.
I thought it was.
Yes, it's a little awkward English, but we want to make sure the intent is there.
Yep. Yes, Madam
and
Chair.
Clear.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
I move LC-1 amendment stated 12907 to House Bill 2212.
Representative Cannon moves LC-1 amendment stated 12907 to House Bill 2212. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, those in the opinion that the -1 amendment stated 12907 should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the call.
Representative Smith?
Call the call.
Aye. Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Motion carries and the -1 amendments have been adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2212 as amended by the -1 amendment stated 12907 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the House Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2212 as amended with the -1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill will be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative
Jensen? Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2212.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Grainier. You may want to stick around for a little later. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on, we're going to have Andy Ginsberg come up. We actually have to gavel in for work session here. We're opening up a work session on this letter, a joint letter to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This would be a joint letter with the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency regarding EPA standard for benzene in gasoline. Andy Ginsberg is the administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality's Air Quality Division, and I've asked him to come forward and brief the committee on the issue before the committee votes regarding sending the letter. And the letter you should have had emailed to you, I think, earlier this week. It's emailed to everybody's office in South Carolina Diamond. Andy, thank you for coming here today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And you have a short presentation that I'll just walk through really briefly to describe the reason for the letter. On page 2 of the presentation, I've listed the health effects of benzene. You can see that benzene is the number 2 air toxic in Oregon, and it causes leukemia and other blood disorders. On page 3, you can see the sources of benzene in Oregon, and you can see that gasoline-powered vehicles and other gasoline engines, such as lawnmowers, are the largest source of benzene in our state. On page 4, the reason for that is given, and that is that the crude oil that from Alaska that is primarily used to produce gasoline for our area has high benzene concentrations, up to 10%. There's low demand for benzene as a chemical feedstock in our area, whereas in other parts of the country, the benzene is removed from the crude oil and used in the chemical industry. We don't have reformulated gasoline required in our area like they do in California and other areas where it's needed to reduce smog. And reformulated gasoline as a side benefit has lower benzene levels. And finally, the gasoline in our area is somewhat isolated because of our pipeline. It's not integrated for the most part with the rest of the nation. So for the most part, what is produced in our area is what serves our area. On page 5, I've just briefly described what EPA proposed in their regulation. This is a national rule that would set a national average benzene content for gasoline. Currently, the national average benzene content is 0.97%, and EPA's rule would require that to go down to 0.62% by the year 2011. The way it's met would be that either a refinery that's over that level can either put in pollution control technology to remove the benzene and get down to the required level, or they can purchase credits from another refinery that is below the level. So they've set up a national averaging banking and trading program. So the net effect is that on average, the benzene content in gasoline in the United States comes down to 0.62%. And the advantage of doing it that way is it's the least cost way to meet the national average. But the disadvantage of doing it is it can leave some areas with higher benzene concentrations in their gasoline, and that's the situation for our area. If you turn to page 6, you'll see a map of the United States broken up into 5 regions, and our area, region 5, has the highest benzene. This is the EPA's estimated benzene concentrations in gasoline after the rule has been implemented, and you can see that our area on average will be over 1% benzene as compared to, say, the East Coast is 0.5%, so double the levels in our part of the country. When EPA originally proposed their regulation, they included an option which would, in addition to the national average, set a cap. And that cap, if you look on page 7, I've illustrated that. The cap would be set at 1.3%, and so in this illustration on the left side, with no cap, a refinery in the Pacific Northwest that's above the 1.3% could purchase credits from another refinery and not make any reductions at all. And you can see the hypothetical East Coast refinery that's below the average would be the one selling them some of those credits. With the cap, any refinery that's above the 1.3% would have to install controls. And because of the way these controls work, they would end up reducing their emissions more than necessary just to meet the cap. So the cap has the effect of bringing us well below the cap level. And so basically the letter is encouraging EPA to include the option that they had considered to, in addition to the national average, to also have the cap. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And committee members, one of the reasons I had asked Mr. Ginsburg to come up is when this first came out, what, about a month ago or so? Or it's even longer, well, as far as there was a lot of media coverage. I heard a lot from my constituents that they had great concerns about this and felt very strongly that the air quality for Northwest citizens should not be compromised. And I've had a lot of discussions with members in the community, with our congressional delegation about this. Certainly, this is not something that we can regulate. However, it is our right to weigh in. And after talking with several members of our congressional delegation, they had suggested that it might not hurt if we wanted to weigh in directly on this. So thus, the letter in front of you. I certainly would open it up to any questions you might have for Mr. Ginsburg or any comments that you might have. And also, as is noted, this would be jointly with the Senate committee. And did they already have a work session on this?
It's already signed by the way.
Okay. So the work session occurred on the Senate side yesterday, and it was passed unanimously?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Ginsburg? Yes.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ginsburg, I guess I'm trying to understand this a little bit better. The mobile source air toxics rule that EPA has adopted.
As proposed.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Would set a national average limit for the amount of benzene in gasoline. So if I understand what this letter is asking in the last paragraph, it says, in particular, we believe it is critical to cap the amount of benzene allowed in gasoline from each refinery that serves our state. Would the MSAT rule not do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that as proposed, the EPA's rule sets an average and it doesn't cap any one area. So that what we're asking is that in addition to the national average of 0.62%, they include a cap so no refinery's annual average can be greater than 1.3%. If our understanding from EPA is that if we had a 1.3% cap, five of the six refineries that serve our area would end up reducing their benzene emissions. Without it, we might not have any. Or we could, but they wouldn't be required to.
Do you have a follow up, Representative Burley?
Yeah. I guess I'm having a little hard time here trying to, rectify dealing with averages, dealing with an absolute figure. A cap is an absolute figure, correct?
Chair Dingfall, Representative Burley, the cap would be set as an annual average, so it's not an absolute per gallon cap. So they can go over it on an individual gallon, but on an annual average basis, their maximum level would be 1.3%.
If I may think about that for a moment.
And Andy, could you clarify how that number for the cap was derived?
Madam Chair, that 1.3% was proposed by EPA. So when EPA staff originally was evaluating this regulation, they considered the national average with and without a cap. As they proposed it, they did not include the cap, but they did include an analysis of what the effects of 1.3% cap would be in their proposal. So it's not a number that we generated. It's just a number that EPA staff considered.
Representative Cannon, I believe you had a question.
Yeah, actually, really just a comment, which is to echo the chair in talking about the number of constituents who have contacted me in the last month about this particular issue who are concerned about the health effects that they get from breathing the air that contains the emissions from this benzene-loaded gasoline. I think it would urge my colleagues to support sending this letter. It seems egregiously unfair that because one happens to live in the Pacific Northwest, one is subject to these cancer risks that are twice what they are in other parts of the country. To Representative Burley's line of questioning, I struggle too with this cap versus average cap, but it does seem clear that under the considered cap, that they did not end up using in their proposal, but that we would ask them to reconsider the benzene level would drop significantly in Northwest Gas, even if on a per gallon basis it did not, or 1 gallon might be higher. What I'm concerned about, and I think what my constituents are concerned about, is the total emissions, which would not depend, would not, we're not concerned about a bad gallon of gasoline. We're concerned about the overall benzene load in the atmosphere.
Thank you for those comments, Representative. Any other questions? Any other comments? No follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. I appreciate that. So, with that, we need a motion.
Well, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt this letter as signatories from this committee. And I probably have, yes, I move that the chair, oh, I got the script here, submit the letter date, the letter in front of us, dated February 2nd, 2007, to the U.S. EPA on behalf of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. And Representative Cannon moves that the chair submit the letter dated February 2nd, 2007. To the U.S. EPA on behalf of the committee. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I assume that will permit a correction of a name misspelling.
Oh, no. Did we misspell your...
That's all right.
How could I get your name wrong? Okay. Good Scottish that you are. I apologize. Having a complicated name, I fight that battle daily. Any other discussion or comments? All right, thank you. So those of the opinion that the letter should be submitted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith.
I don't know where he is. That's
good. Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Jason.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. So the motion carries, and the letter will be submitted to EPA on behalf of the House Committee on Energy and the Environment, as amended with the correct name of one of our members. And with that, I'll close the work session on the benzene letter. I want to thank Mr. Ginsburg for his for being here today. Okay, next I'm going to open up an informational session regarding the Energy Trust of Oregon with Ms. Margie Harris. She's the Executive Director of the Trust, and Ms. Harris, I'll ask you if you can keep your comments to about 10 minutes, and then we'll have questions, and then we're going to move on to the work session on 2210. Colleagues, I had invited Ms. Harris here today because we've heard a lot of discussion about the Oregon Energy Trust. And I thought it would be important, since we are going to continue to hear a lot of energy issues, that the committee have an understanding about the public purposes charge that was under Senate Bill 1149 that was passed in the 1999 legislature, and the role of the Energy Trust in relation to the role of the Oregon Department of Energy. So I appreciate Ms. Harris coming here today, and with that, I will open up an informational session, which I failed. I don't think I did that today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Margie Harris, the Executive Director at the Energy Trust of Oregon, and thank you so much for making time in your busy agenda for me to visit with you today. I wanted to start with a quote from the Wall Street Journal, which rather typifies how mainstream the issues around energy efficiency and renewable energy are today. This is from an October issue, 2006, multi-page insert in the Wall Street Journal regarding energy efficiency and renewables, and item 10 of 10 suggestions related to this subject is customer response programs. John Wellinghoff, a member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, says, and I quote, consumers easily could save billions of dollars annually with only a modest expansion of existing programs and no impact on productivity. What you need, he says, is a willingness to try new things. In 1999, the Oregon legislature indeed tried new things with the passage of Senate Bill 1149, part of which was the creation of the Energy Trust of Oregon and a provision called the Public Purpose Charge. In your packet, which you, I believe, now have, is a outline of my remarks, and I'll begin on page 3 and shortcut them given the time that we have available today. But the leadership shown with Senate Bill 1149 has resulted in many benefits to the state of Oregon. At the Energy Trust, we are the recipient of the majority of the 3% public purpose fund charge that's collected. That results in $50 million a year, a substantial sum to invest in energy efficiency and renewable energy. We're governed by a board of directors of volunteers, a great deal of time, and we are overseen and accountable to the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Through some separate arrangements, we are also able to serve gas customers in the state. That represents the first time in history where we can combine in Oregon the delivery of services for energy efficiency, renewable energy, and on the efficiency side, it's both gas and electric. Our mission is to change how Oregonians produce and use energy by investing in efficient technologies and renewable resources. We do that by leveraging the expertise in the field of businesses who have lots of years of history of delivering services. They are weatherization contractors and solar installers and plumbers and electricians. Many are small businesses, and they partner with us to promote the incentives that we have and provide customers with choices around their energy usage. We have very ambitious strategic goals. It's no coincidence that 300 average megawatts is about equivalent to what a new power plant would produce if it were constructed for fossil fuels. That's a significant amount of energy that we would save, and our intent is to defer the need to build new power plants in Oregon by instead pursuing a softer path, one of energy efficiency and renewables. For the renewable goal, which is to meet 10% of Oregon's electric needs from renewable resources by 2012, that would represent an eightfold increase over what we currently acquire from renewables. We do that by paying down the cost of renewables or closing the gap of the above market cost, making it much more competitive. Overall, what we provide is information and financial assistance in the form of financial incentives to customers interested in investing. There is a great deal of traction and momentum in this area. I've been around this topic for over 30 years, since well before Mike Rainey had to put glasses on his face and read something. We've both been kicking around in that time period, and this is a really perfect storm time for the things that we have cared about for so long. We have strong partnerships. Many are represented in the audience, the Oregon Department of Energy, our work with the League of Oregon Cities to promote wastewater treatment investments and water treatment facilities for municipalities around the state. The industrial customers of Northwest Utilities help design our industrial programs. And we work very hard with the Oregon State University, with the Building Owners and Managers Association, with the Association for Oregon Industries, all of whom have a contribution toward our ability to move energy in the marketplace very differently. Energy efficiency is the cheapest energy we can acquire. It's roughly half the cost of an investment in new fossil fuel generation. It's also the cleanest energy that we can acquire. What the benefits are to the customers is to have a hedge against the rising costs and volatility associated with energy rates, and also to help stabilize their own investment. It's a hedge value. Energy that we save and energy that we generate with renewables also is linked to global warming and provides, that's a good slip, warning. And because regulations are anticipated, this becomes an even more attractive option for carbon, since nothing is emitted, no carbon is emitted from either energy efficiency or renewable investments. Our track record is very solid. We've been around about 5 years, and in that time we've acquired 50% more savings a year for electric energy than the average utility program produced in the prior 20 years. That volume represents very high demand that we have for our programs, and sometimes that demand is greater than we can satisfy, and that represents the potential that's out there beyond what we have funding to pay for. That's enough energy also to heat nearly 100,000 electric Oregon homes or to power 4 cities the size of Bend. On the gas side, we've saved 4.6 million annual therms, and that's enough to heat nearly 10,000 gas-heated homes in Oregon. For renewables, we have 62 average megawatts of renewable generation underway. Those are partnership projects that we've planned and implemented with the utilities as part of their integrated resource plan goals. We've produced over 700 new jobs in Oregon and removed 2 billion pounds of carbon dioxide from our air. So those are good statistics for a committee like this, very interested in those related matters. The following pages describe some energy efficiency results and renewable energy results. They are here for your reference. They represent a broad range of projects in different parts of the state, in different sectors, residential, commercial, and industrial. They also represent a mixture of investment styles, if you will. We invest in changing the market for renewables and in changing the market for new construction, and we also invest in retrofitting of existing buildings. We're also able to serve some customers who in the past have not had opportunities to participate in energy efficiency. Multifamily housing and renters is one such audience, and manufactured home dwellers and owners are another. If you skip to the very end, I will give you another little anecdote regarding our success. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to address the Bonneville Power Administration's Renewable and Energy Conservation Group through Vice President Mike Weedall, who works there. And at the end of my presentation, Mike asked me what I had thought made us so successful in our short time, and he referenced the fact that we started very still as a new organization, having to ramp up very, very quickly. And I think the reasons for that success are multiple. One is that we are a single purpose mission organization, and we're driven and focused on a particular outcome. We are consistent because we have this dedicated and stable source of funding made possible through the legislature. We have this combination of information and financial incentives that's packaged well and that customers can avail themselves of, so it is very easy for them to participate. Our private business partnerships are essential, leveraging those in the field with the expertise to provide services and market those services to customers. And consumer interest in what we do is extremely high right now. So that has been part of our success. And after that, Mike wrote a little email where he said, "You and your staff should be rightfully proud of what you have accomplished. It's fun to have the chance to see organizations such as yours taking an opportunity and making the most of it." Looking ahead, we have many major, large projects, particularly in renewables, underway with the utilities in wind and in very large-scale solar. I hope to be able to come back and share some of that with you once those projects are actually finalized. And on the energy efficiency side, we have actually analyzed that we could get half again as much as we expect to get with our current resources, another 150-plus average megawatts at a very cost-effective rate should we have the opportunity to expand our services. Thank you very much. You have additional information in there on case studies, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have today.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Harris. Any questions or comments? Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Burley. Great having you here, and if you haven't been told by this committee before, the Energy Trust does do a fabulous job, and we thank you for all that work.
Thank you.
Question for you. What steps do you take to work with business? How do they know about you?
Primarily, they know about us because we actively engage what are called trade allies, Representative Smith. We work with trade allies who, in turn, have their own businesses who are insulation or weatherization contractors with long-term expertise. We recruit them. We explain our programs. We help design our programs with their input. We help set incentives for the programs with their input. And then we rely upon them to help give us feedback. They are part of every evaluation that we do about our programs through third-party people who conduct the evaluations. And we use that feedback to then revise program approaches and strategies or to reset incentives accordingly. So they're very engaged. We have a trade ally coordinator. We have trade ally honors and breakfasts that we do. We try and support them, listen to them, since they are, in effect, our field representatives, working most closely with the customers. There are over 600 of them, I should add.
Just a quick follow-up. I might share with you that this legislature also funds a network called the Small Business Development Center Network.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 19 of these centers throughout the state. And they work with about 4,800 small business owners, established small business owners. And I really think there's an opportunity for the Energy Trust of Oregon to partner with Oregon's SBDCs to help in disseminating just information on the benefits of energy conservation and what that could mean to a small business owner, mom-and-pop business owner, up to maybe 100 businesses. And I hope you'd get a hold of them and talk with them, because I really think you could find a great ally in helping to spread your message.
I'd be pleased to do that. Thank you for the suggestion.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you so much for being here and for the work that you do. Members have not noticed the packet that's behind the presentation in their pamphlet. It lists some renewable projects in our own districts that Energy Trust has helped sponsor, and it's very interesting to see those. How does the Energy Trust go about picking the projects that it funds?
We have Madam Chair and Representative Cannon, We have marketing and outreach activities throughout the state, and we rely on that mechanism to attract interest in our programs. We also have an extremely well-developed and used website, and we work with, as I named, a variety of organizations who in turn help us promote and market. Since the marketing budget is a relatively small percentage of the overall dollars that we receive, a lot of it is leveraged through co-branding with the utilities to reach customers through their bill stuffers and newsletters and their links on their websites, all of which creates an atmosphere of interest and attention. Projects come forward to us through the trade allies also that we work with, all the businesses who have marketing and contact with those customers refer projects to us. In the case of industrial customers, we have program development contractors who have expertise in a particular industrial area, like food processing and manufacturing or wood products. And those people are actively beating the pavement and knocking on the doors of companies and suggesting that there be opportunities available to them and working with them to submit projects.
Any other questions, Ms. Sears? Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here, and we may have some other questions down the road, so I might be in contact with you, but I appreciate it. There's been a lot of references to the Energy Trust, mm-hmm. so I thought it was important for the members to understand the role you play in energy efficiency.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And with that, I will close the informational session on the Energy Trust, and we will now start the work session on House Bill 2210. And I have to see if Mr. Graney is still around. Actually, members, we will take a five-minute recess while we try to track down Mr. Graney and make sure all the other members have wanted to say, since we had to switch the order of this. So we'll take a five-minute recess. I will... Colleagues, you have the dash fours in front of you, a little light reading there, and I have asked Mr. Graney to come up once again. You also have the dash threes. We have the dash threes and the dash fours, and I've asked Mr. Graney to come up so he can walk us through them. We also have people in the audience in case we have questions that we can call up. We heard quite a bit of testimony for 2.5 days on these bills. The Dash 4 amendments try to address some of those concerns that were raised, I believe, in the best way possible. I do, for the record, want to thank Legislative Council for working on these amendments in a very expedited manner. So I hope you're listening. And we do appreciate the hard work that they do. We certainly couldn't do what we do without them, so appreciate the work that they've done on this. We are going to have the director, Brainy, walk us through, and this is, in essence, a gut and stuff, partially because there were so many changes with sections, it was easier to read as a new bill. And so I know, colleagues, that may seem, you will see that actually there isn't complete new language, but there was enough new language in changing of sections, actually, that I thought would be easier for us to read as a gut and stuff. So with that, Mr. Graney, if you can walk us through the amendments, appreciate it. And also Mr. Vantoff from the Governor's Office is here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. I'm going to be working off the Dash 4 amendments, which do a number of major changes. First, they delete, going back to the bill itself, as it was originally printed, they delete the provisions that would have expanded the and extended the existing property tax exemption for ethanol and also included biodiesel facilities. Instead, there's a discussion going on to expand the renewable energy zone that provides a property tax exemption and to apply that to that currently is limited to electricity generation, but it would apply to biofuel production facilities as well. That amendment is not in here. That will be brought to the House Revenue Committee for discussion. The parties involved are still working on that, along with the Economic Development Department. Then the new Section 1 replaces sections to start with Section 5 of the bill, and that's the tax credit for producers of biofuel raw materials. It, rather than having the Department of Energy set the tax credit amount and have that be a changing amount, this specifies the different types of materials eligible and puts that in statute. Now you have a series of blanks there, and those blanks, because of the revenue impacts, this tax credit was not included in the governor's budget, will have to be determined in revenue committee. But specify the different feedstocks. We also make a change. The bill as originally drafted, although it was not the intent, would have limited the producer tax credit to ethanol. Would have precluded biodiesel. It also would have precluded fuel for electric generating facilities from, for example, forest wastes. The tax credits in this section now apply to all three types of energy. So it's ethanol, biodiesel, methanol if it's from organic materials such as wood waste, as well as electric generating facilities. Any questions on that? On that section? We move to the renewable fuel standards section.
Chair.
Representative Gurley.
Thank you. I apologize. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, Mr. Graney. I didn't think we were going to take questions here section by section.
Yeah, that might be the best way since we have a lot to cover.
So with respect to the producers of the biofuel raw materials portion of the bill, which is sections 1 through whatever, again, I really want to just make sure we're clear on this. Because the original draft, my concern was that the collector that would deliver to an ethanol or biodiesel plant would qualify for the credit, but not if it went to an electricity generating facility, such as we're trying to get going on East Side. Mm-hmm. But the way this is reworded now, specifically with respect to the definition of biofuel, including solid fuels, that concern is taken care of. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that is correct. And, in fact, there's specific itemization as we go down in Section 5 of the different materials on the amount of tax credit they'll receive for woody biomass.
Right.
And that's the type of material that you're talking about there.
Okay, thank you. Another question, Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Early.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Also, on page 2, lines 1 through 4, with respect to food waste and yard or wood debris collected, as provided under ORS Chapter 459 or 459A, the Oregon, I just want to enter into the record that the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, and Waste Management respectfully request that there be an amendment added to this in the Senate, and I'll leave this with the committee administrator, so I won't read the amendment. But the purpose is to make it clear within the language of this statute that the bill does not unintentionally affect existing solid waste collection programs authorized by ORS 459 and 459A and implemented by cities and counties. The Department of Energy has reviewed this above amendment and sees no conflict or variance from what has been discussed as the objectives.
Madam Chair, Representative Early, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you. And we have that language.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Early, for that clarification.
And one more on this section, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Early.
With respect to the exclusion in the biomass definition on page 2, starting at line 7, where it says biomass does not mean the following four lines: wood fiber derived from late successional forests west of the summit of the Cascade Mountain Range. And subparagraph B, trees with a diameter of no more than 12 inches east of the summit of the Cascade Mountain Range. Madam Chair, I offer that. Obviously there's a lot of issues and a lot of debate that goes on how we manage our forest lands, frankly, of all ownerships, but particularly our federal lands, which is, I think, what a lot of this is designed at. And I think it's important that we recognize that that debate belongs with the federal land management agencies and Congress. There's not, I don't think, a great deal we can do here relative to that. But perhaps more importantly, I think if you look at this reading, what causes me the most concern about this is that it would apply to all ownerships. It is not specific to federal lands. So this language alone, in and of itself, would apply to state-owned lands and privately owned lands. And I, for one, am not willing to make that policy decision in this bill. I don't think it's appropriate. I could go into some of the technical problems associated with this, such as how do we measure a diameter? Is that a breast height or the top of the first log? That's not specified. And a tree that's 20 inches in diameter could be a cull log. That's no good for sawtimber, but would be perfect for biomass. So I just think that this definition or this exclusion is very problematic at best, and I would like to see those lines just dropped out of this bill completely.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, Dave Bantoff from the Governor's Office, for the record. We agree with Representative Burley that these two provisions, the A and B provisions in the amendment, should be taken out of the bill at this time if the committee so chooses.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other discussion on that? Any thoughts? Committee members, there are some issues about clarification, and unless we're going to be working on that for many, many, many weeks, possibly months, we will look at that option.
Moving on then, if there's no other questions on that section.
Representative Burley,
one more,
like,
and this will be much more brief.
Yeah.
And thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me. Also, in the biomass exclusion definition, I just want to call to the committee's attention, and I suspect we're going to have to work on this. Item C says wood treated with, and then it lists some specific things. I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to pronounce some of them. But it does include other chemical compounds, and a chemical compound could include H2O. So I think what we need to do is ask, what are we trying to do with that particular phrase, and make sure we get it clarified.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burley. And would either of you like to comment on that? And what the intent was as far as the, since this is the originally governor's bill, what the intent was for other chemical compounds. Certainly the first three are pretty clear.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the intent, as you can probably guess from the list, is to exclude the types of chemicals listed there. It was not meant to be listing the entire universe of the possible chemicals, but along those lines. So we can have a follow-up in terms of how to clarify that we're not getting at H2O and other types of...
Good point, Representative Burley. Possibly before or after other and before chemical, we want to have some clarification of, you know, treatment. I mean, I'm trying to understand exactly if there's some clarifying, you know, adjective.
Toxic or hazardous or something.
Toxic
like that.
Or hazardous. I mean, the concern is obviously when they're being burned.
Well, I'm sure I suggest DEQ might be able to help us on this a little bit too, perhaps.
So maybe we can, I know that Mr. Ginsburg has already left, who's our air quality expert, but we should certainly confer with him to make sure we're consistent with existing state regulations and statutes on the definition.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for raising that issue. Appreciate that. Okay, any other questions or comments on Section 2?
Madam Chair.
We're going to do this section by section. Representative Cannon.
I do have a comment, and I've expressed this to David and Mike already, and that is just simply that my hope is that the credits for producers for crops could be specified not in statute but by the Department of Energy. And I just think that given we heard testimony about the degree to which these are really moving targets in terms of what is required to make the incentive there for a farmer, depending on the price of wheat, what the trade-offs are, et cetera. And certainly, I think this is an issue probably for the Revenue Committee as it moves there, but I do want to establish for the record that if it's possible, if the Department of Energy and the Governor's Office determine that it's possible under law to not specify the specific dollar amounts in this statute, I would be even more supportive than I already am of this bill. Okay. Thank you.
Do you want to respond, Mr. Rainey, or?
Well, I do think we've done some estimates of revenue impacts and by listing each of these, and I think it which we'd be happy to provide the committee, and we'll provide those to the House Revenue Committee too, and give you a chance to see if you make changes, because this one currently is not in the governor's budget, and in order to hit the levels that we talked about with the Renewable Energy Working Group, we're looking at a revenue impact of about $5 million the next biennium. So it's substantially more than the consumer tax credit, for example, later in the bill. And I think that's one we're going to have to look at very closely because of that revenue impact.
And Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, we will also look at the issue that you raised in terms of whether DOE has the ability to have some flexibility in setting these things over time, whether or not there's an initial number triggered or not.
And committee members, the Revenue Committee will be having a pretty robust discussion about this. And so that's why it has been left blank in this bill, because they will be looking hard at what numbers will make sense and also fit in with the amount of revenue that will be impacted. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, then the next section, moving on to page 7, bottom 7, top of page 8, the renewable fuel standards. And this is the...
Mr. Rainey, if you could just walk through, I don't know if we touched on sections 3 or 4 yet. I just want to make sure we hit section by section to see if there's any questions and that the committee understands what the changes are.
Okay. Sections 3 and 4 and 5 of the bill deal with the production tax credit that we were discussing about previously. So there's change of definition. The tax credit is transferable if you don't have a tax liability. It is provided to transfer to a tax-paying entity under procedures established by the Department of Revenue. And tax credit applies until 2013. So it's a...
Sunsets
in 2013. January 1st,
2013. Okay. So are there any questions from the committee on those sections applying to the producer tax credits? And like they said, Section 5 you see is left blank, and the Revenue Committee will be filling that in.
I might add, too, at the end of that section, there's a direction to the Department of Economic and Community Development to undertake a study of the biennially on the impacts on jobs of this of this section.
This is section, you're referring to section 9A?
Yes, 9A and 9B.
And
quick question on that.
Yeah, just before I go to question, that was a comment that we had heard, I think, Representative Smith had raised, looking at, you know, making sure that the numbers are penciling out, and I think this would be very good information for the legislature to hear. This is something I've argued for with tax incentives for years, and I think this is a real positive step to have this information reported back to the legislature. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair. Mike, do you know, is the department planning on conducting that study internally or contracting that out?
I'm sure it's on here.
Mr. Repine?
The director of department is here. Let's defer to him on that, because they'll be conducting the study, not us.
Sure.
Mr. Repine with Economic and Community Development Department.
Mr. Repine.
For the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Economic and Community Development for the State of Oregon.
It's good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
Hey, the question was, is, are you folks planning on doing the study internally or contracting it out?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, excuse me, Representative Smith, I don't know if we've gotten that far. We do a series of in-house surveying with relative to the activities we do on an annual basis. So whether or not it would be contracted through just a report out from our field representatives to gather the data or use a third party, I don't know. But we would just incorporate it in much of the same data we collect on an annual basis right now.
And I guess the question, the follow-up I have on that, thank you, is are you folks, and maybe it's in here and I just haven't caught it yet, are you folks going to need some statutory language to require the companies to provide that information to you? How are you going to garner that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, again, I haven't had a real chance to kind of mine through that yet, but I suspect we have much of that information already from these companies that we'd be involved in. Some of it could be proprietary, so we have to be careful of what the information we might be sharing, but so we'd have to be very cautious of the end product that we do. But my suspicion is, again, I will go back to the office and check whether or not we have that authority, but I assume we probably do.
But just one last thought on that. Director, you hit on the thought I was going with, and that is making sure it's proprietary, because this is a very, very competitive industry, and folks want to be very sensitive in the information they...
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a good point, Representative. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Repine. So I think we're on to Section 10. Any other questions about Section 9 or Section B, 9A or B? That is a new section in response to some concerns that we have heard. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, and then starting with Section 10 is the renewable fuel standard. There were a number of technical changes, first of all, in definitions, especially regarding biodiesel, and I'm not sure the discussion's entirely ended, but let me mention a couple of the provisions. One is in subsection 2 there on page 8, exclusion of palm oil for biodiesel in terms of the renewable fuel standard. Palm oil presents a number of issues in terms of both fuel quality and also policy in terms of how it's produced, and there's no palm oil produced in Oregon. Of course, the intent of this is to focus on local production to the extent possible. There are a number of technical qualifications there following that paragraph down the rest of the page that requested by the Department of Agriculture that does the fuel quality testing and verification in Oregon, and would need to defer to them to explain if you have detailed questions on those.
I will. Is the Department of Agriculture here? Okay, so when we're done with this, I'm going to call up the Department of Agriculture so they can walk us through these specifically.
Madam Chair, I would just add in Section 10 that there is still a discussion going on in terms of what the appropriate definition for biodiesel should be, and I believe it's the intent of the various interested parties, the governor's office and the chair, to have a work group that will dig into that between now and the Senate side to try and come up with a kind of consensus view on what should be in there.
Thank you, Mr. Bantoff, for that. There was, just to clarify for the committee, and actually I'm going to ask the Department of Agriculture to come up because they were part of this discussion. There was discussions about the definition of biodiesel in particular, whether that needs to be looked at for consistency with California and Washington, And so we wanted to make sure that we were going to be consistent. So we are going to be working with the Department of Agriculture on that. Brent, do you want to come up? I know. You saw you jump. Thank you. If you could walk us through your staff, again, I want to thank the Department of Agriculture, who was very helpful in working through, especially the ASTM standards that you have heard from many people came up and testified. So if you can walk us through those changes, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I might also invite up Russ Wyckoff, who's the administrator of our Weights and Measures Division and can speak to three on down, those sub things. The definition of biodiesel you see there is one that has been was in the original draft of the bill and has been proposed in a couple other states. It does differ from the national accepted definition of biodiesel. It's been adopted by National Conference of Weights and Measures. We've talked with our counterparts in Washington and California. They have looked at the definition that now exists in Section 10.2 and have not adopted that, but have stayed with the nationally accepted standard. And so we're having discussions on those, and as Dave indicated, I think the work group can hopefully work through that issue.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Russ, for being here. Could you walk us through the Section 3? Under subsection 3 under section 10.
Since I don't have the, Madam Chair, I don't have the new version, so I'm not
sure. Provide that to you. Thank you. Yeah, your name for the record also, please.
Yes, my name is Russ Wyckoff. I'm the administrator for Weights and Measures for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The section you applied to, the certificate analysis, section 3, what this is, or it's called the short test that's required of B100. B100 would be the blend stock that was used in the mandate. And it would have to meet the short test of ASTM 6751. And this lists the short test as recommended by the National Biodiesel Board for regulatory officials.
Okay.
There is a longer test that if certificate analysis failed any of these short tests, then the full 6751 test would be applied.
Okay. Thank you. And committee members, I just wanted to add that this was a concern that was brought up by the trucking industry, and we've worked closely with the Oregon Association of Truckers to make sure that their concerns were addressed. You want to talk about their involvement in this
discussion?
Yes,
we had numerous conversations, and the concern was that B100 has been found in some instances to the blend stock, the 6751, not meet the national standards. And most of the problems with the biodiesel would be the result of the B100 not meeting these requirements. So in response to the truckers, we looked at establishing a certificate of analysis that would be done on each production lot of this B100 before it was introduced into the supply chain. And this was the short test that would be required to ensure that the B100 met the quality standards before being mixed with number 2 diesel.
Okay, thank you. And the that certificate would be, my understanding, is paid for by actually the blenders. Is that correct?
Right. What we're looking at with this bill at this time is that the blender would be required to have on hand a certificate of analysis for each lot before it was put into the supply chain. We would then audit that quarterly to see that each lot had the certificate analysis. In addition, we would take random samples to ensure that the fuel met 6751 ASTM standard. That would be paid for by the blender production facility or the terminal that brought in the product.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Department of Agriculture? We have them up there on this testing issue. Okay, I think you answered them all. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your assistance with this. Okay. So we'll move on to Section 11. Then I think we've covered everything under Section 10 there. And actually Section 11, which is the additional testing standards.
Right. Right, Madam Chair. Then sections 13 through 15 established the renewable fuel standard for biodiesel. And in doing so, issues been brought to our attention that a change from the bill as originally drafted uses the word capacity. If you see line 16 there for sub 2 and sub 3 there in line 21 on page 10. Yeah, and I think what we need to do is revert to the original language there. The word capacity has caused some confusion as to whether you actually have to have feedstock produced or not, which was our intent. Capacity, the wording was there in an attempt to make it easier for the Department of Agriculture to track the production, but the wording that's come out is not going to be workable, I don't think.
So you're talking about section 13, subsection 2, which is line 16, and then subsection 3, which is line 21?
Yes, ma'am, sure.
So both of those capacity, which were not in the original bill,
yes,
changes the intent?
Yes.
Okay, and the recommendation is that we go back to the original language?
Yes, ma'am, okay. Sure.
And we've had discussions with several folks who are concerned about that and are in concurrence?
Yes, ma'am, sure, including some of the petroleum dealers and agricultural interests as well.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
Okay.
And then starting with sections 17 through the end of through 19, there is the renewable fuel standard for ethanol. And again, we've got the word capacity.
Hold on a minute, Mr. Rainey. Representative Burley had a question.
I beg your pardon and thank you, Madam Chair. Didn't realize we were going to jump ahead. I had a question about why Section 15 and 16 were in there, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, that was answered by the gentleman from ODA, the Oregon Department of Agriculture. That has to do with the testing and all of that. Is that
correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So which, I'm sorry, you have to make sure we're following you on the sections there.
Okay, then we move down to section 17. And again, we have the capacity.
Madam Chair, in the case of section 17 in 18, the modifications to the original wording that what now refers to a capacity of production facilities is the amendments that are being proposed, and we're recommending that we retain those amendments for purposes of the ethanol.
What line?
Section
17.
Sub 2, line 20, line 28,
yeah.
One capacity of ethanol production facilities. And then again, in line 5, mm-hmm, on page 13, sub A, the capacity of ethanol production facilities.
And your recommendation is?
That the amendments, as you see here, be put into the bill.
Okay. And you want to talk about the number? The number has changed under the ethanol, correct?
Clarification, Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Cannon?
Sorry, the capacity, on the diesel, we are going back to we're clarifying that instead of capacity, what we really mean is the actual production.
Correct.
Are you recommending and are you proposing amendments that would do the same for ethanol?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, no, we're recommending that with respect to ethanol, we adopt the amendments that are proposed in this draft here.
Let me clarify. What happened was, I think there was an attempt to have consistent language when it actually changed the intent of the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, real briefly, there's different circumstances involved in kind of the ethanol and the biodiesel production side, and we've worked with the stakeholders to try and meet the needs of both of those industries. And so there is a different treatment as being proposed here. And really, I think the main difference is that biodiesel is looked at as potential. We're tying the fuel standard to production of Northwest feedstock, and in doing that, we want to make sure that production is actually purchased, utilized, and produced to trigger the fuel standard. With ethanol, we don't have that concern, and the stakeholders are amenable to having a production capacity become the basis for the trigger of that standard. The practical implications are that the ethanol standard would be triggered more quickly than the biodiesel trigger.
Thank you, Mr. Van Hoff. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. Any other questions? And also, you might want to note that the number has changed,
yes,
in the ethanol.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's gone from 90 million gallons to 40 million gallons, and that reflects the fact that there will be production facility online. We expect later this year producing 40 million gallons.
And at, where is that facility?
That's at Port of Morrow, Pacific Ethanol Facility.
Okay. So that's when we did hear from, came and testified.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that was the same testimony we heard. Okay, Section 18.
And then, Section 18, I believe, is unchanged from the original bill. That's a companion section on the E10 requirement, 10% ethanol, for once the production level of in-state produced ethanol has kicked in.
Okay.
Any questions on that section? Then the next section is gasoline additive restrictions on pages 14 and 15. I believe that's unchanged from the bill as drafted, isn't it?
Madam Chair, there's minor technical changes to that provision that had been worked out with the various stakeholders.
This is the MPTE?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
MTBE, sorry.
MTBE and other toxic materials.
Section, any other changes, sections 21 through 24?
I don't believe so. No, no other changes.
I don't recall any changes in section 25
no.
either.
No, so it brings us to the biofuel consumer income tax credit. We did a couple of changes there. Let's see.
And I apologize, committee members, the sections have been renumbered, so that's why it is a little bit confusing from the original bill, but that's why I want to make sure everyone is comfortable with the language that's either in here or that we're proposing for additional amendments.
This is the valid section.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair,
yes.
The major change to that section was we actually created, the Legislative Council created a new section 28. That applies to home heating and would allow a consumer credit when using at least a 20% blend of biodiesel for purposes of home heating.
Okay. Any questions on that section? I think Representative Cannon, this was a comment that you had made.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Cannon, I might add, too, in connection with the comments you made in the earlier tax credits, this one still has us establishing the rate, although actually I thought that was going to be changed by Legislative Council, but it wasn't. But in discussing this, when we go to the House Revenue Committee to discuss both tax credits, the issue that's been raised by our Attorney General, and I only had a chance to trade voicemails with her, we haven't followed up yet, is that for the legislature to provide us the authority to actually set changing rates, the procedural requirements would have to be very specific in statute. And I don't think they do it right now. We'll need to work on whether that approach would work or whether you simply set the rate in statute. And it would apply to both tax credits, both the consumer tax credit and the producer of raw material tax credit earlier. So it's the same issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that clarification.
Then the next section on energy facility siting exemptions, there was no change.
That was that's section 33?
Yes. That's no change. Then we have the sections on exclusive farm use for on-farm biofuel production. The intent was, overall intent of the legislature was, legislation was not changed. There was, I believe, some technical clarifications consistent with existing land use law. And you see some of that on page 26.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, that those changes were made at with the inclusion of DLCD and the Farm Bureau talking through and making sure that the provisions did what was intended under the original intent of the bill.
Okay, and I've spoken with the Farm Bureau. I know they're back there and they're nodding their heads, so they've reviewed these provisions and are comfortable with that. And we've also been working, thank you, I know DLCD isn't here, but appreciate their work on that.
Yeah. And you see some more changes towards the end of the sections on land use on page 51 and top of page 52 that are parallel changes.
Katie, do you want to come up and say anything? Or? Yeah, I just want to make sure if there's any questions. I think there was a question about what these changes were before and wanted to see if there were any other questions about this language. You maybe just briefly describe what exactly this does and make sure that mm-hmm. the committee is clear on that.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. There were a few changes made to the land use section at our request, and I'll just run through those real quickly. The first is for an outright use in an exclusive farm zone, it would allow the processing of biofuels that are exclusively grown on that farm or by that landowner. It would also allow for the processing of biofuels when the landowner is going to use 100% of that biofuel process. So he's not growing those crops himself, but he's going to utilize 100% of the fuel on his own farm. It would also allow for custom processing of biofuels for other landowners in the area for their use. That is in, so that would require no permitting outright use in a farm zone. A permitted use in a farm zone would come from one-fourth of the crops processed would be from that landowner's farm, and it would have to be done in an area of less than 100 square feet. The third type of use, it would be a conditional use permit, and that would be in conjunction with a farm use, and it's also subject to the approval of a governing body. There's already numerous conditional uses allowed in the statute. This just adds it to the statute.
Okay. Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fast, the term custom processing, I think I know what that means, but why don't you elaborate so I make sure that I my understanding is correct?
Yes, happy to. It would be a situation where one farmer in an area has made the expense of purchasing the equipment to do the processing of biofuels. Farmers have crops that they've grown in the area. They would take it to that farm. He would process it for them, and they would take the fuel back.
Follow up if I could.
So the
essence of it is that the raw material is received from a party and then processed and then turned back to the same party.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And further follow up. In the area strikes me as a pretty spongy reference. Is that defined?
I don't believe it is. And in response to that, talking to our members who are starting to dive into the biofuels industry, they're seeing a need that for biodiesel, it's more economical to have some smaller processing plants out in the farm areas so that they're not spending the expense and the energy of trucking these crops back and forth. I think it would have to look at kind of a reasonable zone. It is not defined.
It just seems like it's an invitation to possible confusion. I'm just wondering if there, a mile radius or something that would be a reasonable
thing to do. I think we're probably pretty flexible as to what it might be. I just unclear enough. I mean, some might say the Pacific Northwest is an area, and I don't think that's what's intended.
And that's not the intent of this. And we're happy. I know that there's a desire on the committee to move forward, and I guess I would make a pledge that I could work with the governor's office on a more defined term if that's the will of the committee.
Yeah, fine with me.
We'll discuss that, and it could be that this is something we have a continued discussion with the Senate. I would like to talk to DLCD since they were involved with this language as well to see if they have any thoughts. So the one concern I might have is that obviously for different counties, I mean, by having a set radius, it's going to be different in Harney County than, you know, Union County just because of the size of the county. So I don't also want to constrain it so we can have that discussion.
I appreciate that.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, in Section 38, there's a change. The effective date, again, just for the land use provisions, is in tax years on or after July 1st, 2008, which is different from the original bill, was 2006. And that's based on the tax assessment years of the property.
Are there any questions about that? And then the effective
date is unchanged.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for walking us through this. And are there any other questions or clarifications before we close the work session?
Sorry. Make a motion.
Well, Representative Burley.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, before you, you should have a copy of a letter I received the other day from Bend Oil Company, and I'd encourage you to look at this because, you know, as much as I support this policy and want to see this happen, I'm also very cognizant of and concerned about the impact it'll have at the retail level. And Mr. Vantoff and I have discussed this. A lot of people have thought about it, but I did get this letter from a constituent. He did raise a couple of concerns. Mr. Vantoff has the letter, and he's also going to take a look at some things relative to this. But the one thing I do want to call your attention to, again, on the second page of this letter, item number four, is the comment about, from a transportation perspective, if a truck loads in Portland and heads for Central Oregon, cannot be delivering different blends at each delivery stop. And, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to the owner of Bend Oil Company, and this is a pretty big concern for him. So, you know, we've been having some discussions about some preemption language, and I'm more than happy to work with the chair and the members of the committee and LOC and others and see if we can get something worked out where we might be in some agreement. But I want to point out that from the retailers and distributors' perspective, this is an issue.
Thank you, Representative Burley. Would anybody else like to have any comments or before we close the work session? I appreciate that. And I do see the League, I think, is in the audience. So I hope you'd be willing to sit down and talk with us about that. Thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2210. The work session will continue on Monday. That is the plan right now, if all is in place. You've heard some of the discussions we've had here today, so we're hoping that we will have a clean bill with additional amendments that we can be looking at on Monday as well.
Thank you, ma'am.
With that, I would close the work session. Thank you, committee members, for your attention. We've gone through a lot of information here and appreciate it. And I know you'll read the bill again this weekend to make sure that you're clear with all the specifics.